This is the web stream of KBOO Portland. KBOO is 100% community supported. If you have not yet become a member, go to the website kboo.fm and click on the tip jar.
Housing and transportation and food. And what that shows is that 44% of children are in low-income families in Oregon, families at or below 200% of the federal poverty level. The reason why this is important is because childhood poverty correlates with a whole host of adverse outcomes. Children in poverty are less likely to do well in school. They're more likely to drop out of school. The incidence of abuse and neglect are higher for children in poverty. Chronic health problems are more likely, and unfortunately, the list goes on and on. So this is a very important indicator of the health of our state.
I read that while the economy is improving and less people are unemployed, they're not employed at a level that keeps them out of low income and poverty parameters.
There are a lot of different factors that are causing that, but yeah, you're right. We need to make sure that we're investing in programs that help remedy that.
Are there pieces of legislation going on in the current session that you want folks to get involved with and keep an eye on?
No doubt. One of the programs is employment-related daycare, and we are working to make sure that the budget that legislators down in Salem passed fully funds employment-related daycare. So that's something that I would encourage folks to visit our website, cffo.org, see how they can help the Save ERDC Coalition. Another program that we're working to support is Temporary Assistance for Needy Families. It's a critical program to assist families and help them move out of poverty. It provides cash assistance to families in need, and the goal is to help move them out of poverty so that some of these adverse effects of poverty on children are reversed. Temporary Assistance for Needy Families hasn't received the investment in recent years that is needed in order to help struggling families. As the economy gets worse, the state receives less revenue, and policymakers struggle. They have difficulty investing in those programs that families really need. Simultaneously, the need for these families, for these programs, actually increases. So the need for temporary assistance for needy families is greater when the economy is doing worse. Meanwhile, there's less funds in Salem for policymakers to distribute. And again, we want to encourage policymakers to continue to invest in those programs that support families in need. And if anything, these numbers, nearly a quarter of kids in poverty in the state, support policymakers investing in those programs.
Richard Myers, Children First for Oregon, and your website is cffo.org.
Really appreciate you focusing on these issues and bringing more attention to these really important numbers that just came out.
For KBOO News, this is Robin Ryan.
According to a presentation made to Multnomah County's Board of Commissioners, homelessness, especially among veterans, families, women, and disabled adults, has worsened over the last year. Mary Lee, a division manager in Multnomah County's Department of Human Services, says the problem is largely economic. Lee cited a few ways the county is combating homelessness, including the Housing First program, which helps homeless individuals get cheap housing quickly and conveniently. The county manager expanded on how the weak economy contributed to homelessness in Multnomah County when she spoke to KBOO's Ben Renner.
How does the local economy affect homelessness and the marginalized in the county?
The case we're trying to make is a couple things. One is we live in a regional environment. So thinking about solely what happens in the city of Portland or even Multnomah County misses the extent to which we are all interrelated and dependent upon each other, at the very least of Washington, Clackamas, and Multnomah counties, but certainly we think in an intersection with Clark County as well. So that's sort of like the biggest frame, right? The second frame is to look at what the HUD department at the federal level says is fair market rent for housing here in the Portland metropolitan area, which is a little bit over $17 an hour. When you look at the minimum wage for both Washington State and Oregon, our rates don't even come close to meeting that minimum level in order to avoid being rent burdened, which is defined as paying more than 30% of your monthly income towards your rent. We have one of the highest minimum wage rates in the country, and we are still not able to ensure that someone who's working 40 hours a week at a minimum wage job can actually afford their housing without being tremendously rent burdened. And you have then challenges in paying for food and clothing and health insurance and all those other things that you and I, everyone needs to be able to live successfully. The third piece that we think you have to look at is what jobs in the Portland metropolitan area pay a wage that could get you to that either fair market rate housing wage or to a self-sufficiency range for instance, a family, a single-headed household with two children. And in the metro region, there is one job that of the top 10 jobs you can get in the metro region that pays that, and that is registered nurse. When you look at the other nine top 10 of the top 10 jobs, none of them gets you to that $17 an hour fair market rent, nor does it get you to the $23 self-sufficiency wage that you need to be able to afford your housing and your food and your clothing and all of those kinds of things. So that's the third thing. When we talk to folks who are homeless and we say, what caused your homelessness? How is it you became homeless? The vast majority of them give reasons that are economically based. They lost their job. They lost their housing, which is a construct of not being able to have income. They're fleeing a domestic violence situation, which, you know, when women leave domestic violence, their income goes down if they were dependent upon it. So the vast majority of people whom we talk to and survey say they're homeless due to largely economic issues. So when you look at all of those layers, you begin to understand that this is not about personal predilection or character defect. There is something structural going on here, and we've done very good work to be able to rapidly rehouse and place folks in housing, even with bad credit history, eviction records, and our very tight housing market. However, keeping them in that housing is a very different discussion that really comes down to an economic one.
What services need to be improved over the next 10 years?
There's a couple places that we think are just so common sense and have such a high return on the investment that it makes no sense that we don't invest more fully. So first of all is rent assistance. We have a shared system of short-term rent assistance that all of the jurisdictions contribute to. And the average amount of assistance that a household gets from that rent assistance is 1 to 3 months, or a very small portion. When you look at the numbers of people who are still stably housed 6 months after getting that 1 month of rent assistance, it's incredibly high. It's in the 80s or 90s, right? So for that type of investment, people are then maintaining stable housing after the investment ends, right? After the rent assistance ends, in incredibly numbers. In general, I think what we need to do as a community, and we have had a lot of conversation with our board about this, is to look at economic development through a lens of human capital, versus a more traditional looking at how do you incentivize businesses, how do you use tax breaks, how do you get people to locate their businesses here, all of which are great. But in the long run, we believe that particularly for the county, our mission is the development of human capital. You know, research shows that the more folks in a community who have at least an associate's degree, the higher earning capacity there is for the entire community. So we invest in education. When people look at issues of equity and racial and ethnic justice, those aren't just good moral issues. Those actually translate into economic prosperity and a greater ability for a community to grow its economic capacity. When you get people who are low income on a stable source of income, they spend those dollars in the local economy, driving a greater capacity for the community as a whole to function. These are some examples of the development of human capital, which you can invest in, one can invest in the same ways in which we invest in tax credits, tax incentives, luring businesses to open here.
That was Mary Lee, Division Manager with Multnomah County's Department of Human Services, speaking with KBOO's Ben Renner. The data compiled by the county showed that the percentage of homeless individuals out of the total population is higher here than in King County, Washington, which includes Seattle.
Today, the Oregon Senate passed a bill that would grant driving privileges to undocumented immigrants. Senate Bill 833 directs the DMV to grant a driver's card to applicants who fail to provide proof of U.S. citizenship as long as they provide identification from their country of origin and meet all other requirements related to obtaining a driver's license. The so-called temporary driver's license would be valid for a period of 4 years. Homeless people, veterans, and the elderly would also reportedly qualify for this license. According to the Statesman Journal, the driver's card cannot be used as legal identification for scenarios not related to driving, such as boarding a plane or purchasing firearms. The bill, which is introduced on April 2nd, comes after a two-year effort to create bipartisan legislation reportedly aimed at reducing the number of uninsured drivers on the road. A contentious public hearing was held 2 weeks ago. Critics said the legislation encourages criminal activity, while supporters said the bill helps working people. The bill passed the Senate today by a vote of 20-7 and now heads to the House, which is expected to vote on the legislation by the end of the week.
A bill requiring OLCC involvement in agreements between local bars and neighborhood residents failed to get House approval. House Bill 3256 would have given neighbors of local bars recourse in dealing with mounting complaints about noise, parking, and other agreement violations. The House voted it down, citing concerns of the bill requiring OLCC to be involved in non-alcoholic-related issues, such as litter. Good neighbor agreement laws currently have no enforcement agency, which is a source of frustration for groups like the Northeast Coalition of Neighborhoods, the bill's sponsor. The Coalition's Safety and Livability Committee is now working with other community organizations to rewrite the bill.
The Hillsborough School District plans to cut 50 teaching positions for the upcoming school year. According to the Oregonian, the planned layoffs would be a first for the district, which has cut 240 positions in the past 5 years through attrition. Superintendent Mike Scott told the school board last night that cuts through resignations and retirements will no longer work for the district. In addition to the staffing cuts, the district is also planning on removing another 5 days from the school year. In 2008, the district made national headlines when it cut 17 days. The district is looking to cut $8.5 million from its budget. Teachers facing a potential layoff will be informed by May 3rd.
You are listening to the KBOO Evening News. Stay tuned for Free Speech Radio News at 5:30, followed by The Underground at 6, hosted by the KBOO Youth Collective, focusing on American youth issues, including school, activism, and local events. At 7, it's a special broadcast of the Illahi Lecture Series. Tonight, Catherine Austin Fitz speaks about who owns our economy and what you can do about it. Tomorrow's weather is clear and sunny with a high of 73 degrees.
It's 5:17. Time now for daily commentary from Jim Hightower.
So your heart doctor says to you, we need to do a little open heart surgery to make a minor tweak in your blood flow. Whoa, time for a second opinion. That's why Senator Bernie Sanders of Vermont is such a useful citizen. When confronted with a wonky conventional wisdom of economic experts, his common sense kicks in, causing him to question authority and seek a second opinion. For example, Sanders is presently questioning Wall Street, the corporate media, Republican lawmakers, and the Obama White House for their insistence that our Social Security program needs a little operation. No worries, they say, for we're only talking about a minor tweak called the chained CPI. It's merely a reworking of the consumer price index, they claim, and it will not, repeat not, cut benefits, but simply adjust the flow of annual cost of living increases in the program. BS alert, shouts Bernie. While these well-off cognoscenti won't notice a downward adjustment in their payments, It would be a real hit to typical retirees who count on that money for more than two-thirds of their incomes. Sanders points out that the change proposed by Obama would mean that today's 65-year-old retirees would each lose more than $650 a year by their 75th birthday. That's not a tweak, it's a cut. And it's especially painful when you're trying to make ends meet on $14,000 a year. When the elite policy wonks and politicos claim that change CPI is a more accurate measure of inflation, they're completely ignorant of the reality of life for the elderly. Most 75-year-olds aren't buying new cars or 70-inch TVs. The biggest chunk of their meager incomes go to health care, which is grossly inflationary. This is Jim Hightower saying, to stay connected to reality on the Social Security fight, connect with Bernie at sanders.senate.gov.
To get more of Jim Hightower's populist take on what Wall Street and Washington are up to, visit www.hightowerlowdown.org.
A high-profile law that sparked conversations about government transparency had some very low-profile changes last week. The Stock Act, enacted last April to prevent members of Congress from insider trading, was modified. Changes to the law now limit the visibility of financial disclosures for non-elected government employees. The revisions allows lobbyists, staffers, and aides to not have their investments publicized through government websites or public databases. The original law required lawmakers to reveal electronic documentation of their investments 18 months after the bill was signed. Another change from last week extends that date to January 2014. The recent modifications to the Stock Act were supported unanimously, taking only 4 days to pass.
And now we hear the latest in worker-related news from our friends at laborradio.org.
You're listening to WIN, Workers Independent News, a production of Diversified Media Enterprises. I'm Doug Cunningham. Hundreds of building trades union leaders and members in Washington for the Building Trades 2013 National Legislative Conference will rally today in support of the Keystone XL pipeline project. The building trades unions say they want a renewed focus and energy on America's continuing jobs crisis, and they say that effort can begin by approving the Keystone XL pipeline. Utility workers President Michael Langford says America could create a serious 21st century greening of our economy through smart, substantial investments in infrastructure upgrades and replacement.
We lose methane gas from natural gas from leaking pipes into the air, which equates to 120 million automobiles. And the electrical grid voltage and line loss alone is phenomenal. And so just by improving all these, to me, will help green the economy, but also help our members because, I mean, these are all good-paying jobs, and not only our members, but building trades and others.
Langford says the U.S. is falling behind other nations in the quality and condition of our infrastructure, and he says rebuilding U.S. infrastructure using state-of-the-art green technology to cope with the impact of climate change is essential, but he says it's being held back by Wall Street's profits obsession.
Post-Sandy, it's crazy to go back up there and rebuild a system just like it was. So it's a system, the electric, we're working off a 19th century system. We need to upgrade it, and there's ways to upgrade it. There's been technological advancements that Europe and Asia's using. We're just not doing it because it's all about Wall Street and profits.
More than 100 striking yellow checker Star Transportation taxi drivers took a bus from Las Vegas to a demonstration at the state capitol at Carson City, Nevada, Tuesday. The taxi drivers were there to demonstrate against the assembly's failure to bring Assembly Bill 329 to a vote. That bill would prohibit long hauling, running up the meter on passengers by traveling longer than necessary. The striking Las Vegas taxi drivers are members of ITPEU, OPEIU. More than 700 drivers have been on strike against Yellow Checker Star since March 3rd. Issues include wages and compensation and long hours with no overtime pay. Many drivers were making below minimum wage until a complaint was filed and a settlement was reached requiring Yellow Checker Star to pay more than $387,000 in back wages. The union also alleges unfair labor practices by Yellow Checker Star. Union workers united with other concerned Boston citizens to protect the funeral service of a Boston Marathon victim from a small Kansas religious cult known for shocking and offensive funeral protests. The Teamsters said their members and others served as human shields at the funeral of Crystal Campbell on Monday. The hate group didn't show up. Sean O'Brien, president of Teamsters Local 25, says he's committed to making certain that loved ones of the bombing victims can grieve in peace. You've been listening to WIND, Workers Independent News. For more information, visit laborradio.org.
The World Health Organization, or WHO, warned that the new strain of the bird flu is unusually lethal. WHO Assistant Director General Keiji Fukuda said the H7N9 virus is one of the most dangerous viruses he has seen. 22 people have now been killed by the bird flu in China. Fukuda said in a news conference in Beijing today that the virus is more easily transmitted from chickens to humans than H5N1, which killed 332 people from 2004 to 2007. The WHO expects many more infections in China because doctors still do not fully understand the virus and how it spreads so easily between species. Taiwanese authorities announced today that they have confirmed the first human infection by H7N9 in Taiwan. The 53-year-old man is reported to be in critical condition. According to the Taiwanese Center for Disease Control, the man was not exposed to poultry at all. So far, however, there is no evidence of human-to-human transmission of the deadly virus. Shanghai's live poultry market was shut down on April 6th and has seen a large slowdown of human infection since. The virus primarily manifests in the elderly and has been asymptomatic in some cases and very severe in others. Overall, 108 H7N9 cases have been reported in China.
In the latest news from U.S.-occupied Afghanistan, NATO reports that Afghan and coalition forces killed 13 insurgents in northeastern Afghanistan today. Yesterday, two members of the International Security Assistance Force were killed in an attack by insurgents in eastern Afghanistan. According to an envoy with the United Nations, civilian casualties in Afghanistan have increased by 30% since the beginning of the year. The envoy called the rise in violence troubling. In Seattle, a U.S. soldier charged with the murder of 16 Afghan civilians appeared in court on Tuesday. Robert Bales is accused of slipping away from his base on March 11, 2012, and going on a killing spree, murdering 16 Afghan villagers, mostly women and children. Speculating on the conditions following a possible conviction, the prosecution and defense reportedly argued over who might testify in support of Bales at a sentencing hearing. Bales, who faces the death penalty, has yet to enter any plea.
And now, the latest news and developments from the occupied territories in Palestine from the International Middle East Media Center in Bethlehem.
Welcome to Palestine Today, a service of the International Middle East Media Center, www.imemc.org, for Wednesday, April 24, 2013. Two Palestinians injured in the West Bank by army gunfire, and in Gaza, the Israeli Navy attacked Palestinian fishermen. These stories and more coming up. Stay tuned. The Israeli army shot and wounded two Palestinian youths near a security fence close to Jenin City in the northern part of the occupied West Bank. The army alleges that the two Palestinians intended to infiltrate into Israel, but did not provide additional information except the fact that they were unarmed. Israeli media sources reported that one of the wounded suffered serious injuries and was moved to an Israeli hospital, while the second, who apparently suffered minor injuries, was kidnapped by the army and was taken to unknown destination. The harsh economic situation in the occupied territories pushes thousands of Palestinians to seek work in Israel, but the majority of them are not granted work permits, an issue that pushes them to seek alternative means to enter Israel. Elsewhere, Israeli bulldozers of the Jerusalem City Council, accompanied by Israeli soldiers and police officers, demolished three vacant brand-new apartments in Attur town in occupied East Jerusalem. The Israeli Jerusalem municipality claimed that the two apartments have been built without construction permits. Each apartment is 500 square meters. Owner of the building, Kayid Jaradat, told local news that this is the third attack of its kind and added that his family has been living in their old home connected to the demolished apartments since 1997. In related news, the army demolished two homes under construction in Shuch al-Arub town, north of the southern West Bank city of Hebron on Wednesday. In the Gaza Strip on Wednesday, Israeli Navy boats opened fire at a number of Palestinian fishing boats at the Gaza coast, an issue that forced them to go back shore without being able to fish. Eyewitnesses at that Navy fired dozens of live rounds into the air and few rounds at the fishing boats while the fishermen were in the 3 nautical miles allotted to them by Israel. Under the Oslo Accords in the mid-90s, the Palestinians are allowed to fish in 20 nautical miles off Gaza shore. But in 2008, Israel unilaterally reduced the fishing area to 3 nautical miles. As part of the ceasefire agreement that ended the Israeli war on Gaza in November 2012, Palestinian fishermen were allowed to fish within 6 nautical miles of the Gaza coast, but the army continued to attack them in their allotted areas. And that's all for today from the IMEMC News. This was the Wednesday, April 24th News Roundup from the occupied Palestinian territories. For more news and updates, please visit our website at www.imemc.org. Today's report has been brought to you by Hassam Kassis and me, Ghassam Barnoura.
You are listening to the KABU Evening News. This is a volunteer-produced newscast, and we encourage your participation. Call us with your breaking news stories at 503-231-8032. Our production team for tonight's newscast is Jemai Sherry and Robin Ryan. The producer is Ben Renner. Our engineer is Kurt Lauer. The KABU Evening News and Public Affairs Director is Rebecca Ney. A podcast of local stories from this newscast is available on our website at kboo.fm/eveningnews. The local number for Senator Ron Wyden is 503-326-7525. The number for Senator Jeff Merkley is 503-326-3386. And Portland Mayor Charlie Hales can be reached at 503-823-4120. You are listening to KBOO Portland, 90.7 FM, on K264AA in Corvallis, on 100.7 FM, and K220HR in Hood River on 91.9 FM. I'm Brian Pritchett.
And I'm Nia Lewis. Coming up tomorrow morning on KBOO, at 7, it's Democracy Now! With Amy Goodman and Juan Gonzalez. At 8, on Voices from the Edge, talk radio host Joanne Hardesty speaks with two representatives of the Passage to Higher Education program at PCC Cascade, Noni Kazi, program coordinator, and Tony Funches, student mentor. They will talk about preparing African-American women for college. At 9, hear Press Watch, news you're not supposed to know, with Teresa Mitchell. At 9:30, listen to A Deeper Look to learn about the transformed U.S. military and intelligence apparatus with Pulitzer Prize-winning journalist Mark Mazzetti on his new book, The Way of the Knife, The CIA, A Secret Army, and a War at the Ends of the Earth. At 10, it's Air Cascadia, headlines, interviews, and commentary with Chris Andre. At 10:15, hear Flashpoints, investigative news radio with host Dennis Bernstein. At 11 on Between the Covers, host David Naiman interviews celebrated author Karen Russell, who was nominated for the Pulitzer Prize in Fiction last year for her debut novel, Swamplandia. And at 11:30, it's The Film Show with Jen Chavez and SW Concert. Thanks, KBOO members, for your generous support in our membership drive. It is still not too late to go to kboo.fm and click on Donate Today. And stay tuned now for more national and international news from the worker-run collective at Free Speech Radio News. Have a lovely evening.
This is Free Speech Radio News for Wednesday, April 24th, 2013. In Mountain View, California, I'm Dorian Marina. Coming up, in Bangladesh, more than 100 workers are killed and hundreds more injured following the collapse of a garment factory building. As activists continue pressure on government officials to pass immigration reform, two significant court decisions this week could affect U.S. deportation policy. And a Yemeni activist travels to Washington to testify at the Senate's first hearing on the targeted killing program. He says drones are killing civilians and making the region more dangerous. Those stories and more coming up.
I'm Jess Burns with headlines for FSRN. As Pakistan's caretaker government prepares national elections, violence aimed at secular left-wing candidates and election workers has increased. The past 36 hours has seen 8 elections-related bombings. The Taliban is suspected to be behind the attacks. FSRN's Gabe Matthews reports from Pakistan.
Soon after Pakistan's caregiver government announced it would conduct free and fair elections, Taliban militants issued warnings to 3 left-wing parties. Over the past 2 days, violence against campaign workers has increased. There have been 8 bomb blasts in 3 provinces. 12 people are dead, and dozens have been injured. Ghulam Bulur, a ministerial candidate running as a member of the left-wing Awami National Party, lost one of his brothers in a Taliban bomb attack in December. Bulur escaped that attack, but today his election workers were once again targeted.
I am not afraid of the attacks and killings. I am deeply grieved for the young dead people and my security guard. I openly tell Taliban militants to kill me if you think that will allow you to win power and bring Sharia law. But I beg you to forgive the young people and stop killing these innocent youth.
Elections are scheduled for May 11th. I'm Sean Rang, reading for Gabe Matthews in Peshawar.
The trial of Russian opposition leader Alexei Navalny got underway today. The face of the Russian opposition movement stands accused of embezzling from a government agency during a timber sale. Navalny and his supporters say the charges are politically motivated. FSRN's Yekaterina Danilova reports.
The case against Navalny is a case against us. Activists chanted at demonstrations in St. Petersburg and other cities today. During the trial, Navalny said criminal allegations were brought because of his work documented corruption in state-owned companies and exposing organized election fraud by the ruling party. He also said the trial is meant to tarnish his reputation.
The most important reason the trial is happening is to create an absolutely deceitful PR campaign to be carried out by the state media.